The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
The International Court of Justice made a momentous ruling today. Myanmar must take steps to prevent a genocide against Rohingya Muslims. A Rohingya activist says it's been a painful journey, but today speaks to the resilience of her people.
You know, the ability to live, to survive with nothing, with zero and below, we're still here.
The impeachment trial of President Trump continued in the Senate today. Democrats want to know how Republicans could not demand more witnesses.
Unless that is, they're not interested in the truth, that they're afraid of the truth.
And more international companies are building fertilizer plants in Africa.
So this factory can meet all of Ghana's demands for fertilizer.
Fertilizer boosts crop yields but brings a steep environmental cost. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Witnesses and documents. That's what the Democrats continue to demand as their opening arguments in President Trump's impeachment trial continue today. Before today's session even began, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer hammered that home.
I don't see how any senator, Democrat or Republican, could sit on the floor, listen to Adam Schiff and the House impeachment managers, and not demand witnesses and documents. Unless that is, they're not interested in the truth, that they're afraid of the truth, that they know the president is hiding the truth.
The Democrats first talked about what the president did, the pressure campaign on Ukraine, withholding aid in return for a favor. Here's Representative Sylvia Garcia, one of seven House managers, making the case against the president.
We will discuss the evidence that shows overwhelmingly that President Trump directed this scheme with corrupt intent.
The Democrats built their case today for the first article of impeachment, abuse of power. Representative Jerry Nadler called the president's conduct dangerous and illegal.
Since President George Washington took office in 1789, no president has abused his power in this way. Let me say that again. No president has ever used his office to compel a foreign nation to help him cheat in our elections.
Nadler said that the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress, will be presented tomorrow.
Taken together, the articles and the evidence conclusively establish that President Trump has placed his own personal political interests first. He has placed them above our national security, above our free and fair elections, and above our system of checks and balances. This conduct is not America first. It is Donald Trump first.
And just minutes into today's impeachment trial, the man at the center of it all, President Trump, took to Twitter. By the way, yesterday Trump broke his record for the most tweets in any single day of his presidency, 142 posts or reposts. Today, the president tweeted about swapping witnesses. The Democrats don't want a witness trade, Trump tweeted, saying that would be a big problem for them. Lead House Manager Adam Schiff rejected the idea yesterday, saying this isn't a fantasy football trade. You may be wondering what the rest of the senators are doing. Not much. Talking during the trial is forbidden under penalty of imprisonment. Many senators are taking the risk, though, and whispering to each other or passing notes, you know, just like seventh grade. They also can't have phones or tablets, so when they're not taking notes, some are playing with fidget spinners and sharing candy. Again, junior high. Also, under the rules, only two beverages are allowed, water or milk. Some senators have been seen enjoying some chocolate with their glasses of milk. Republican Senator Patrick Toomey from Pennsylvania made sure that Hershey's chocolate made it into these deliberations. The Democrats hold the floor today and tomorrow. The tables will turn on Saturday when the president's legal defense team will be given its chance. When you strip away all the details of the impeachment case, who said what to whom and when, at the center of it all is this question. What is the U.S. relationship with Ukraine? Deputy White House Counsel Michael Papura hit on that this week.
Providing lethal aid to Ukraine. President Trump has proven himself to be a better friend and ally to Ukraine than his predecessor.
So for the U.S., how do we define good friend and ally in respect to Ukraine? To answer that, Horacio Lutsevich with Chatham House joins me from London. Horacio, what do you think? Is Trump a better friend to Ukraine than Obama was, or is it simplistic to frame things that way?
I think it's a bit like framing it in the beauty pageant way. I think what it means to be a friend and ally in international affairs is to act upon common values and common vision for the world we all want to live in. And I would say that Obama was more, in a way, expressive in standing on the same values with Ukraine, talking a lot about importance of the international law and multinational institutions, providing a lot of support for reforms in Ukraine, paying attention to Ukraine's democracy, than President Trump.
Mm. So let's recall that that war started when Obama was president. That was in 2014, the war between Ukraine and Russia in the east of Ukraine. Continuing the scorecard, Deputy White House Counsel Purpura mentions that Trump has supplied lethal weapons to Ukraine. We're talking about the javelins, the anti-tank missiles. President Obama did not supply Kyiv with lethal weapons when the war broke out because the reasoning was he didn't want to amplify fighting, although he did provide millions in non-lethal assistance. So both White Houses seem to have logical reasons. What do you think? If you're Ukraine, is one of those policy approaches smarter?
I think this is a certain grudge that Ukraine and some parts of Ukrainian population, expert community have against Obama, because he clearly saw provision of lethal aid as a possible escalation to the conflict. And this is something nobody wanted. But we must also recall that Obama was working in cohort with Angela Merkel, with the German chancellor, with the Normandy format, where she actually was also urging, in a way, against a provision of lethal weapons, trying to mediate in a diplomatic and more political way. Of course, the way that military aid continued to flow with the certain gaps that we know now, and the fact that President Trump did provide, release this military lethal aid to Ukraine is important.
One of the conditions of the lethal aid from Trump is that the Javelin missiles are not on the front lines of Ukraine's war with Russia. These missiles are hundreds of miles in the West. So what is lethal assistance if Ukraine isn't actually using it?
I personally, myself, at times was arguing as well for providing lethal assistance because it raises the cost for Russia in this conflict. I mean, when Russia invaded Ukraine, Ukraine had 5,000 soldiers with no, combat experience, with tanks that had no running capacity, the engines were broken. This was not a country prepared for an aggression. So this lethal assistance helps upping this cost for Russia for any further military invasion. It also helps Ukraine to train better, to be prepared for NATO comparabilities, because Ukraine declares, regardless of what NATO thinks right now, its aspiration to join the collective security organization.
So you're saying even if the Javelin missiles are not on the front lines, just the presence of them in Ukraine somewhere is inhibiting for Putin?
Yes, and it gives more confidence to Ukrainian armed forces. It also, gives more confidence to Ukraine as a nation, knowing that it has such a powerful ally as United States willing to help Ukraine militarily.
I mean, for sure, Obama and Trump are dealing with very different personalities in Kyiv at different times, even vastly different political cultures. So as we kind of unpack who is better to Ukraine, I think it's important to ask, what does Ukraine need right now?
It's a very important question. I think in a way Ukraine's wish list remains the same. Ukraine has still an unfinished domestic transformation agenda. Ukraine fights corruption, and this is something that came up a lot in the Republican rhetoric, how corrupt is Ukraine. Actually, Ukraine became less and less corrupt since 2014. Mm. Ukraine closed a lot of gaps in corruption. And of course, Ukraine needs strong bipartisan support, because as we started speaking, this is the case of a country that is trying to build a system based on democratic values, human rights, liberty and freedom, something that United States is about.
Aresia Lutsevich with Chatham House in London, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We tend to think of a restraining order as a legal tool to protect a single person from an abuser. But today, the International Court of Justice at The Hague issued a sort of restraining order against an entire country. The UN ruled that Myanmar must implement emergency measures to prevent a genocidal campaign against Rohingya Muslims. CBC journalist Nahla Ayed was in the courtroom at The Hague when the ruling came down.
What the court ordered is essentially a restraining order, which is meant to protect Rohingya Muslims who are still in Myanmar, while the court looks at the bigger case of whether genocide actually happened in Myanmar against Rohingya people. You'll recall that last year, it was the small country, African country of the Gambia, that brought these accusations forward against Myanmar, alleging acts of genocide. And that is a case that could take years to decide. And that is why they sought what they called an emergency hearing, in which they argued that there should be some kind of injunction that would compel Myanmar to essentially stop any violence with genocidal intent against the Rohingya peoples.
The big question is, will this ruling, this restraining order, actually change anything? Many people involved with this case are optimistic, like Gambia's Justice Minister, Abubakar Tambadou. He led the team that launched that lawsuit against Myanmar. You spoke with him this morning. Let's hear this.
The fact that they had appeared here during the hearings at very senior level, the fact that they had appeared today, this morning, shows that Myanmar is acting as a responsible member of the international community. I believe that consistent with that attitude, they will comply with the court's orders today.
So, Nala, this ruling essentially puts Myanmar under court oversight, but the court has no enforcement power unless the ruling gets a firm backing from the UN Security Council. So what do you think that would take, especially with the veto power of China, a supporter of Myanmar? And what would the Security Council ultimately be able to do?
Well, you've just put your finger exactly on why this has taken so long to get to any kind of international court. Because of the inertia at the Security Council, there's not likely to be action if Myanmar doesn't comply. Still, the oversight is important as far as people here are concerned that I've spoken to. They say that somebody now is officially on the international level actually watching and keeping tabs on what Myanmar is doing or not doing. In effect, it's putting Myanmar on notice.
Some of our listeners will remember that Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel laureate and de facto leader of Myanmar, she showed up at the court last month. She denied that her country acted with genocidal intent in its treatment of the Rohingya, but she did physically appear before the court and had these comments.
Regrettably, the Gambia has placed before the court an incomplete and misleading factual picture of the situation in Rakhine State in Myanmar. Yet it is of the utmost importance that the court assess the situation obtaining on the ground in Rakhine dispassionately and accurately.
Nala, what do you think the chances are that Aung San Suu Kyi will implement the court's ruling and protect the Rohingya?
Well, if you go by what she wrote in the Financial Times today, the answer actually isn't clear-cut. Here's a couple of things she kind of notes. One is that the case against Myanmar before the ICJ is, what she says, relying extensively on a fact-finding mission by the UN Human Rights Council that she says is dependent on statements by refugees in camps in Bangladesh, and she says that she fears that those may be inaccurate. And she also quotes a report from an investigation by her own government that has concluded that there is no evidence of genocide, but that there is evidence that war crimes might have been committed. And so she concludes by saying we need time, adequate time, to let domestic justice run its course.
What happens next, Nala? Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees are still in refugee camps in Bangladesh. What does the future hold for them?
I did connect with people in Kutupalong camp, the largest refugee camp in the world. And apparently people were listening on radios, on phones, very interested. And I spoke here in The Hague with someone who pretty much represents their view, Yasmin Olaf, who is a Canadian Rohingya activist who was sitting in the court for the entire proceedings, and it's been a very emotional day for her.
Although there are many broken parts and bits and pieces within the United Nations system or other accountability and justice mechanisms, we got here. And that says something about the resilience of our people, you know, the ability to live, to survive with nothing minus, you know, negative, with zero and below. We're still here. And, you know, we're very grateful that we're able to witness it.
It is a breakthrough that perhaps might have been unexpected a couple of years ago. The international justice system hasn't had a lot of breakthroughs lately.
Journalist Nala Ayed, the host of the CBC's Idea, speaking with us from The Hague. Nala, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This week, The World and the Center for Public Integrity are looking at the impact of fertilizer use around the globe. We reported yesterday that there's growing concern about the nitrogen pollution that comes from fertilizer and its impact on climate change. But the agriculture sector in Africa is focused on the opposite problem, getting more fertilizer to farmers to boost crop yields. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports on new efforts and challenges in doing that.
For decades, fertilizer was too expensive for African farmers. It had to be imported, and transportation into the continent was expensive. Now, though, Africa's turning a corner toward producing fertilizer locally. International companies and the African Development Bank are building or helping to build fertilizer plants in Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nigeria that are already boosting farmers' yields. And this summer in Ghana, Vice President Mohamed Bawumia stood proudly before the largest fertilizer plant ever built in the country.
So this factory can meet all of Ghana's demands for fertilizer.
The ultra-modern facility in the coastal town of Tema is the first in a national plan to build fertilizer plants in every district of the country.
We therefore don't really have any reason to be furthermore importing more and more fertilizer and wasting our foreign exchange.
The wide acceptance of fertilizer in Africa has been a long time coming. Hank Bremen was Africa director for the International Fertilizer Development Center.
You had efforts to get fertilizer adopted in the 60s, the 70s, but it didn't become a success because the cost-benefit were not favorable at all.
And Bremen says there was resistance to fertilizer from some in Africa who, remembering the colonialism that dominated the continent, didn't want to be dependent on foreign corporations. Or they preferred more natural farming. But he says those methods don't produce enough.
That will not feed the African population at present.
There's growing concern among scientists internationally about the expanding role that nitrogen pollution from fertilizer is playing in climate change. But the agricultural sector in Africa is focused on a different problem. Fertilizer production here has increased, but distribution challenges remain, including increasing reports of fertilizer being stolen and smuggled.
The concerns of the farmers come after several reports of smuggled, subsidized fertilizers from Ghana to neighboring.
This is a video shared by the Peasant Farmers Association of Ghana. Farmers in it say they haven't received their share of fertilizer, which is typically distributed by the government.
Our concern is that, for how long can we continue to wait?
Everybody's aware this time. It's not easy for everybody.
If you cannot get subsidized fertilizer, it frustrates you.
I visited a farmer in the interior Volta region of Ghana.
Okay, you are welcome. I'm known as Ochame Ampedu.
80-year-old Ochame Ampedu says there hasn't been a government agriculture agent here to distribute fertilizer in 2 years.
Usually, agri-corps the suppliers fertilizers.
Ampedu raises citrus fruit, coconuts.
Now experimenting avocado.
And now he's trying his hand at avocados because he hasn't had much luck with any crops. In a dark shed, he keeps one last burlap bag of fertilizer leaning up against a wall.
Yeah, very good.
The bag's still mostly full. Ampedu says he's saving it for when he really needs it, although he knows one bag won't make a big difference. So public-private partnerships have built fertilizer plants across Africa, like the one that just opened in Ghana. But Marie-Claire Kalighangabo says now they need to do more to make sure fertilizer actually reaches farmers. Kalighangabo finances fertilizer projects for the Africa Development Bank. She spoke last year at an African fertilizer conference.
Private sector has to play a key role in ensuring that quality fertilizer gets to the farmer at the right time and the right moment.
She says everyone realizes they need to work together to solve this last stubborn problem.
We all know that agriculture is the key in the development of the continent.
And the key to successful agriculture in Africa, she and others say, is more fertilizer. They know it has environmental side effects, but right now, increasing yields is a higher priority. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy in the Volta region of Ghana.
To read more about the link between fertilizer and climate change, head to our website, theworld.org. The Trump administration unveiled new visa rules this morning. Their focus? Pregnant women. The rules would make it more difficult for pregnant women to obtain tourist visas to come to the U.S. Sarah Pierce is an analyst at the Migration Policy Institute.
The Trump administration is very concerned that a lot of women want to come to the United States to give birth because we have something called birthright citizenship, in which every child who's born on U.S. land, essentially, is a U.S. citizen and is a U.S. citizen for life. So they're concerned that a lot of people are coming to the United States just for the purposes of getting that. These rules are the first time we're ever going to have in regulations saying that it's not okay for someone to use a tourist visa for the purposes of coming to the United States and giving birth to a child that will then have U.S. citizenship. That's been coined birth tourism, and it's something that the Trump administration has long wanted to crack down on.
And as I understand it, with these rules, consular officers will be in charge of determining whether or not a person is coming to the U.S. primarily to give birth. I mean, isn't that kind of difficult to do with any certainty?
It's extremely difficult to do. Also, consular officers are restricted from asking if an applicant is pregnant or asking if an applicant intends to get pregnant. So it's going to have to be limited situations in which it naturally comes up, or there's some other evidence that makes the consular officer believe this person is likely to give birth in the United States. So it's problematic. It's problematic and potentially invasive for these applicants.
So why do you think, Sarah, the administration is doing this? Have these visa rules been proposed before?
I think this is really mostly a symbolic gesture saying that the administration is against birth tourism and is trying to come down on this issue. If they were really passionate about birth tourism, I think they could pour a lot of resources into going after the companies that really perpetuate this industry. There are companies in the United States that advertise to foreign nationals, hey, we'll help you out. We'll coach you through the visa interview. We'll house you while you're finishing your pregnancy and we'll help set you up with medical care. Those companies are perpetuating visa fraud, and that's a way more effective way at going after this industry than just sort of creating these awkward visa requirements that consular officers are going to have a lot of trouble implementing.
What are the questions about the legality of this, of asking questions about pregnancy to visa applicants?
There are questions about discrimination and equal protection. Is this going to cause women to have a much more difficult time to obtain B2 visas than it is men? We're going to have to look at the effect of the regulations to decide whether or not there's a real discriminatory effect and intent here that can be sued on in U.S. courts. I think it's unlikely that there could be a lawsuit on the face of the regulation.
Do you think this new visa policy starts to eat away at birthright citizenship?
Not in effect. Like I said, I don't think that this policy is going to have a big effect on the ground. I think it's more symbolic. And you're right, though, because this administration has said before that they are interested in getting rid of birthright citizenship, it's definitely raising concerns that they're going to close in on that issue.
Sarah Pierce, an immigration attorney and analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. Thanks for being with us and explaining this.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The World. The blazes in Australia have claimed the lives of three American firefighters, but North American crews remain on the front lines.
You pick up and take off. It, as far as the eye can see, is on fire. And it's very difficult to understand where each fire is. It's just everywhere.
The challenge of fighting Australia's bushfires, that's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. The story of a new virus that first emerged in Wuhan, China, seems to be evolving minute by minute. World health leaders have been meeting today and yesterday, wrestling with whether to declare this new coronavirus, a respiratory illness, a public health emergency of international concern. And this evening in Geneva, Dr. Didier Houssin, the head of the Special Emergency Committee, announced...
Now is not the time. That's a bit too early to consider that this event is a public health emergency of international concern.
So it is not a global health emergency. The World's Alana Gordon has been following this. What was their reasoning, Alana, not to put the emergency label on this virus?
So a public health emergency of international concern, it's a very specific designation. And at the time of this announcement today, the WHO had reported there's been at least 584 cases of this new coronavirus and at least 17 deaths. But almost all of those cases, except 9, have been in China, and all of the deaths have been in China. So here's Dr. Tedros. He's head of the WHO and what he had to say earlier today.
Make no mistake,
This is, though, an emergency in China. But it has not yet become a global health emergency.
So what this committee is saying that it hasn't quite reached the level of an international public health emergency, and for at this point at least, it's a regional emergency. At the same time, it's a completely evolving situation, and Dr. Tedros has emphasized that this could change as they learn more.
I have to say, those comments are surprising. I mean, we're hearing about cases outside of China. There's a case here in the U.S. Airports have been set up for screenings for people coming back from Wuhan. Just today, passengers were screened right here in Boston.
Yeah, again, it's an evolving situation, but the key questions, the key things that they're looking at, they're still knowns and unknowns, is how virulent this virus is, like how severe it can be in people, and also how contagious it is. And so they're still trying to figure those things out. Think about like these disease detectives trying to figure out how much information they have, whether it's to be a global health emergency or not. And there's implications both ways. So, for example, we do know that it's a respiratory illness. Symptoms are coughing. It can develop into pneumonia. But there are these unknowns. And even within the people that have died, Dr. Tedros said many of them, most of them had other health conditions as well.
Is there a downside to declaring an international emergency like this?
It's a totally tricky balance. So even this committee was divided. They met yesterday. They were supposed to come out with an announcement. And then they're like, we need to talk about this more. And that was spoken about today. There's divisions. There's implications when you declare an emergency. There can be financial impacts on a country when an emergency is declared. And it also depends on the disease itself. So when Ebola was declared a public health emergency in the Democratic Republic of the Congo earlier last year, that had a very specific intent, too, to attract more resources and more support. And I talked to Dr. Amish Adalja. He's an infectious disease doctor at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. And he says in this sort of case, a place like China has a lot of resources.
There is always the concern when you do raise an alarm about an outbreak in a given nation that other nations will penalize that country by enacting travel bans or stigmatizing it or doing all sorts of things. And that all has to be weighed when you're declaring a public health emergency of international concern.
So that leads me back to Wuhan in China and other cities. China's halted all travel in and out. I mean, Wuhan's 11 million people. What's the implication of that?
People are divided about it. On the one hand, social distancing is a really important tool when you have a contagious virus, or in this case, it appears to be one that's transmitted through droplets. And so on the one hand, by being further apart, maybe not gathering all in one place, that can be really useful to prevent a disease from spreading. On the other hand, when you have a lot of halting of movement and everything else, that can create more panic or have unintended consequences. So you might have people hiding their illness or trying to sneak out.
The World's Alana Gordon, thanks very much for the update.
Thanks.
Venezuela's opposition leader Juan Guaido addressed the rich and powerful at Davos, Switzerland today and pleaded for international help. Guaido said Venezuela is in the midst of an unprecedented tragedy. The presidency of Nicolas Maduro is to blame, says Guaido, and many international leaders agree. It was a year ago today when Guaido declared himself acting president, but the opposition leader was not able to oust Maduro, and the year since then has seen ongoing protests, food shortages, and the detention of many Venezuelans. Alfredo Romero is a human rights lawyer in Caracas. His group, Foro Penal Venezolano, gives pro bono legal help to victims of human rights violations. I asked Romero how many political prisoners are currently detained in Venezuela.
Right now, we have 388 political prisoners, but it is important to understand that it's not just the number that we have today. It's a number that varies every week because the government incarcerate people, new people, and also release some people. So they have what we call the revolving door effect. So this number is the number this week, but maybe it will vary the next week.
And some of the political prisoners who've been there the longest, like how many months or years?
Yeah, there are people that have been for 14 years, for example, and there are some other people that have been for days. So
388, is that a record for Venezuela? I mean, have you seen this many people in detention for political reasons before?
It is important to understand that Venezuela has the highest number of political prisoners in the Americas, even higher than in Cuba. We ended 2019 with the highest number of political prisoners in Venezuela.
Right, and the numbers have been steadily growing. Why now? What's driving these detentions?
What is important to understand that in Maduro's regime, there have been more than 15,000 political detainees since Maduro is in power. So what has been growing is the number of people that have been detained, not the number of political prisoners, because again, they don't want to keep a very high number each week. So that's why they release some people and they incarcerate new ones. The important thing is intimidation effect that they have when they incarcerate a person, for example, for 2 days. They incarcerate and torture someone for 2 days, and the intimidation effect to the population is very high.
So is there some general reason why these prisoners are seen as a threat to the government of Nicolas Maduro?
Well, there are different kind of categories of political prisoners. There are people that just protest and they're being in jail for days. They don't represent a real threat, but they incarcerate them indiscriminately. Whenever there are mass protests, they incarcerate a lot of people, but they release it immediately. But whenever there are not mass protests, like right now, they incarcerate selectively specific people that represent a threat for the government.
Alfredo, what kind of conditions are these political prisoners held in? And does that vary?
Most political prisoners are subjected to torture. When I'm talking about torture, I'm talking about using like plastic bags, suffocate them. Of course, they beat them. They use electric shocks and things like that. Most of political prisoners are subjected to torture in different ways on different levels. Also, an important thing to understand is that most political prisoners have health issues. So we have said that these health issues are actually intentional. It means that they don't provide medical assistance as a way or as a method of torture and intimidation of political prisoners. For example, there is a doctor whose name is Jose Alberto Marulanda. He was beaten, he was tortured in different ways, and he's right now with health issues as a consequence of torture. Mm. There is another guy whose name is William Saguado. He was also tortured, and he has also health issues as a consequence of torture. And that's why we believe that this is intentional. They don't provide medical assistance to these prisoners, so they keep them with health issues, and of course, they become worse and worse. So that's a regular thing that is happening with all political prisoners.
How successful are you, Alfredo, and the lawyers and activists you work with in freeing detainees in Venezuela?
Very interesting question. We have represented more than 11,000 people since 2014, and, wow, and most of them have been released. So if you put it in numbers, then you will say, okay, you're being very successful. Yeah, maybe. If we weren't there assisting, you know, pro bono, all these people, maybe nobody knows how many political prisoners are, how many detainees, and the government didn't have any political cost. That's our question. However, we're being successful from the micro level perspective. So it means that here in my office, where I'm right now, there are lines of people waiting for us in order to talk to us. I mean, the mother of, you know, of Juan, for example, who's waiting for us. Whenever Juan is released, we are successful and the mother is happy. But repression has increased. So again, we help the individuals, but we haven't been successful, you know, stopping repression. We haven't been successful in decreasing repression. So repression has increased and the government has a method and they use repression in order to intimidate people. And the intimidation effect grows and grows every day.
Alfredo Romero is a human rights lawyer in Caracas who provides free legal assistance to detainees and victims of human rights violations. Thank you for speaking with us, Alfredo.
Thank you so much.
2 million people are expected to flee Venezuela's crisis this year, and many of them are leaving on foot. The mass migration is putting a strain on Venezuela's neighbors. Near the Colombian-Venezuelan border, reporter Teresa Cotzeriles introduces us to one woman who stepped in to help.
Marta Duque lives in a white brick house in Pamplona, Colombia, a sleepy college town in the mountains. It's a cold Friday night, and when she opens her front gate, at least 100 Venezuelan migrants are waiting for her outside. A volunteer ushers families with young children into Duque's house. I came here with my mom, says a 6-year-old boy sitting on Duque's steps. I'm going to Bogota, says the girl next to him. Inside, Duque is walking in a brisk loop between each room in her house, showing people where to sleep. This is where the littlest children sleep, Duque says, the babies and their mothers.
Women with young children file into a room lined with Disney blankets and padded floor mats. A volunteer comes in with a platter of ham and cheese sandwiches. Raquel Sandeno claims a mat with her three children. Her daughters are 11 and 9. Her son is 10 months old. She used to work at a school in Carabobo, Venezuela, and I ask her why she left. Because we were almost dying of hunger, she says. Her family walked the whole way here, Sandeno says. It took all day. Thousands of Venezuelans like Sandeno cross into Colombia every day. Many hope to find work in cities like Bogota or Lima, hundreds of miles away from here. So, if they can't afford a bus ticket, they walk. Usually for days, sometimes with small children. Their main route takes them through Colombia's mountains and right past Duque's house. Duque's responded to this by converting her home into one of the only local migrant shelters in the area. According to an unofficial log she keeps, she says she helps 300 to 500 migrants a day. I started doing this like any normal person would, Duque says, when I saw people in front of my house in the cold and rain. The migrants' climb through the mountains is dangerous. One of the mountain passes is 10,000 feet above sea level, and a lot of migrants make the trip in flip-flops or Crocs.
La gente se destruye los pies caminando.
They destroy their feet walking, Duque says. She says she's massaged children's numb feet with hot water and soap and warmed up migrants with hair dryers when she thought they were getting hypothermic.
Me impacta mucho las mujeres embarazadas avanzando.
The ones who really stick with me are the pregnant women who make this trip when they're 8, sometimes 9 months along, Duque says. After walking all day, sometimes they arrive at my house already dilated. They're in pain, but they tell me they want to keep going. Colombia's welcomed Venezuela's migrants. Over 1.4 million have already settled here. But the government's also resisted building shelters or refugee camps for them. Duque doesn't receive any government support for her work. She's cobbled together funding from international aid organizations. Some of her neighbors support what she's doing. Others complain.
A mí me han hecho varios intentos de cerrarme.
They've tried to shut me down a couple times, Duque says. Anti-Venezuelan attitudes are on the rise in Colombia. In 2018, Pamplona's mayor briefly closed Duque's shelter in response to a community petition. Duque successfully reversed that decision with the help of local activists and sympathetic press coverage. Duque's been a community activist for decades, and migrants' rights is personal for her. That's because Duque's a former migrant herself. When Colombia was in the throes of a bloody civil war decades ago, Venezuela was the country people migrated to back then. Thousands of Colombian domestic workers cooked and cleaned for Venezuelan families. And when Duque was 12, her father sent her to work in Venezuela.
Caracas era el otro lado del mundo para mí.
Caracas was the other side of the world for me, she says. She was hired by a wealthy family, but they never paid her. She says they told her she was still paying off her debt from her trip across the border. When she threatened to leave, they said they'd turn her into the police. Duque says this dragged on for 2 years.
Entonces, de ahí pues, yo empecé a sentir...
That's how I came to believe that the most important thing to any human being is freedom, she says. After Duque shows the young mothers and children to their rooms, she and a volunteer stand on her front stoop with a platter of sandwiches. It's time to feed everyone else. All right, she shouts, listen, everyone get in line. You can faintly hear a group of mothers singing to their children from inside. A police officer once told me, do you think anyone will thank you for this? Duque says, I don't expect anything from people. I never did any of this to be given something back. She walks back inside to check on her kitchen. Tomorrow, she'll do this all again. For the world, Teresa Cotsarillas, Pamplona, Colombia.
Teresa's reporting was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation. You're listening to The World. In Australia today, three American firefighters died while helping to battle the bushfires there. They were flying a plane carrying fire retardant, and it crashed in the mountains south of Canberra, Australia's capital. In a press conference, Commissioner of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, Shane Fitzsimmons, said the cause of the crash is being investigated.
It is a confronting and sobering reminder of the inherent dangers and risks associated with firefighting, and we've seen all too often, unfortunately, this season, the very tragic consequences that can come as a result of these significant bushfires that we've seen burning across New South Wales.
Hot and windy conditions have returned to the region. More than 80 fires are still burning there. Hundreds of firefighters from the U.S. and Canada have helped in Australia during this devastating fire season. Joel Curley is a firefighter in a helicopter unit. He's just arrived back in the U.S. after helping out in Australia for the past several weeks. He's usually based in Boise, Idaho, where he works to fight wildfires for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Joel, first of all, our condolences to you and to the entire firefighting community. This must be devastating news for your teams. When did you hear the news of the crash and the deaths?
It is, Marco. It's extremely devastating. I just landed here in LAX connecting to Boise, and my phone, of course, got lots of text messages, and so I knew something had happened and called my wife, and she let me know about it.
I know you were stationed near the scene of the crash. What are the fire conditions there?
The fire conditions are extreme drought, and I know yesterday was one of the hottest days that we've had in, you know, 10 days or so into the hundreds. Again, in any kind of day that they have with those types of temperatures coupled with the drought, is it's very likely that they're going to have extreme fire activity on those days.
Help us understand the level of complexity and risk involved in piloting one of these planes through these conditions in Australia right now.
Well, I can't speak to what this incident, the factors that were involved in this, but when I was there, it was very smoky conditions, low visibility, and of course, flying in any kind of hot weather up high, it affects a lot of characteristics, you know, of the airplane. So it's very dangerous, but these are the most well-trained pilots in the world that do this. And again, without having any information about it, I wouldn't want to say much more than that.
Compared to what you've seen in Idaho and the northwest of the U.S., how different is firefighting in Australia right now than what you've seen?
The biggest difference that I saw was just the sheer vastness of all of the fires there. I mean, any time that you pick up and take off, it as far as the eye can see is on fire, and it's very difficult to understand where each fire is. It's just everywhere. As far as the conditions, it's very similar to, say, a California. You know, of course, they have the eucalyptus, which burns very hot, very fast, much like a lot of the fuel types in California.
Have you fought fires in California from your base in Idaho? Have you gone there?
Yeah. Yes, lots of times.
I'm wondering if you would go back to Australia to fight fires in the future. And I'm also thinking about the increase of deadly wildfires everywhere around the world and the actual population of people like you who are skilled to fight them. Are there enough of you?
When you experience a season like this, just like in the United States in the past, we've used this agreement with Australia, New Zealanders, Mexico, Canada. We have quite a few agreements, and anytime one of the countries experiences just such a massive season like they're having, we're surely there to help. And I would go back again in a heartbeat. In a heartbeat, I would.
Joel, did you know anybody on that plane?
Yeah.
Can you share us a memory about them?
Again, I don't want to. It's just really fresh information that I have, so
I understand.
I just like to decline for now.
Again, our condolences to you, Joel.
I appreciate that. I do.
thanks very much for being with us. Joel Curley, an American firefighter based in Boise, Idaho, just back from Australia. Thank you.
Thank you. I always appreciate the coverage that all you guys are doing. You know, it's really important for all Americans, Canadians, and the Australians to know that everybody's hearing about them and thinking about them.
Thank you very much for the work you do.
You bet.
Back now to the action in Washington, the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Today on the Senate floor, Democrats began by talking about what the president did, the pressure campaign on Ukraine, withholding aid in return for a favor. Then the Democrats outlined the case for the first article of impeachment, abuse of power. Representative Sylvia Garcia is one of seven House managers building that argument. She said President Trump is also promoting a debunked conspiracy theory from Russia that Ukraine tried to meddle in the 2016 presidential election.
Our own president is helping our adversary attack our processes and to help his own reelection.
Next for the Democrats, explaining the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress. The president's legal team will get their chance to respond on Saturday. One of the president's attorneys, Jay Sekulow, gave a preview of their defense today, speaking during a recess. He said the evidence does not amount to an impeachable offense. Trump's defense team has repeatedly said no crime has been committed. Finally today, countdown to doomsday. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists uses the doomsday clock as a symbolic measure of how close the planet is to complete annihilation. This morning in Washington, the doomsday clock got reset. The new timing? We are 100 seconds to midnight. If we ever actually get to midnight, cue Porky Pig, because that's all, folks. Seriously, though, what do those 100 seconds actually mean? It is the closest to doomsday the clock has been since the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists set up this gauge in 1947 to warn about the danger of nuclear war. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, the clock was 7 minutes to midnight. Right after the end of the Cold War in 1991, the world looked pretty safe from nuclear Armageddon, and the clock slid back to 17 minutes before midnight. Today, 100 seconds. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists says the global danger comes from powerful leaders who, quote, denigrate and discard the most effective methods for addressing complex threats. As for me and you, we're not giving in to doom. We'll be back with you tomorrow. It's only a day away. Not even. 23 hours. Think positive. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. See you then.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.